Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
This podcast features the return of former President Bill Clinton celebrating his 35th reunion at the Yale Law School on Saturday, October 4th, 2008. President Clinton spoke to several thousand law school alumni, faculty, staff, and students at Woolsey Hall on the subject of our global challenges.
Thank you very much, Dean Coe. Thank you for your service in the administration. Thank you for that interesting and occasionally embarrassing introduction. I'd like to also welcome all of you here and thank my classmates who are here for their friendship and for those who served in the administration. In addition to them and your dean, I also was honored that Guido Calabresi agreed to serve on the Second Circuit. I don't know if he's here or not because I don't see so well anymore. Judge, stand up there. I'm glad to see you. Thank you. Thank you. This is going to be largely a question and answer section. Harold told me he collected some questions, and I find that they're always better. If you're answering questions, at least you're talking about something someone else is interested in. And I also think at reunions, people should learn to listen to each other, because I always fear, you know, when you get to, especially when you reach my age, you go into one of these reunions and you have your mind sort of programmed that you're supposed to ask these questions, and you're trying to make sure to ask all the questions, and sometimes you don't hear the answers. There is a hilarious cartoon in today's New York Daily News, which I recommend to all of you. A man and a woman are talking under a banner that says, "Welcome back, class of 73, my class." So this man's talking to the woman, and the first question is, "Anything interesting happened to you?" She said, "Yeah, 9 years ago, I was abducted by space aliens and taken into outer space." Next frame, he says, "Do you have any children?" So, go figure. I will try to listen better. I do want to say just a couple of things. First of all, I am profoundly grateful to Yale Law School for the friends I made, for the professors I had, for the things I learned. And of course, as the dean said, because I met Hillary here. And she called me right before I left the house. I live about an hour and a half from here, and said that she hoped that her classmates would forgive her for not showing up, but she's campaigning for Senator Obama and she thought it was more important that she do that. I am very grateful to those of you who served in the administration, for those of you who helped in my campaign, or Hillary's, or both. I want to say just a couple of words about Yale and about the subject I've been asked to address today that I think will be manifest in some of Harold's questions. I came here for three reasons. One, you heard when he read, I wanted to become a lawyer because I wanted a job where I could die with my boots on. It's a crazy thing when you're 23 years old to think you want a job from which you can never be forced to retire, but it was a big deal to me. I came here because of the emphasis that existed then on law and policy, on the intersection of what the rules are and how they really affect people's lives and the challenges that inevitably come and change generation after generation. And I was not disappointed. I came here because I love politics, and I had a chance to work for a man running for the Senate named Joe Duffy, who didn't win and later became head of the USIA when I became president. And I learned a lot about Connecticut and its politics and fell in love with the place. I learned a lot here about a lot of things, but I want to say one thing that I think is particularly important because we have forgotten about it too often in the last 28 years. In several of my classes, I was impressed that I had teachers that I agreed with politically who were nonetheless rigorous about making sure I knew the facts before I formed an opinion. Political and civil rights, the Professor Emerson. Of course, I took with Burke Marshall, a man I admired just about as much as anybody I ever knew. And I still remember my evidence class with the Professor Hazard because I thought it was a great thing that there were certain rules of fairness and fact and argument that ought to be followed, I thought, not only in a court of law, but also whenever possible in political discourse, since when you're running for office, you can't be trusted to be entirely fair about yourself and your opponent. There have to be some intermediary institutions, and in its best form, that's one of the things the political press can do for us. But we have been making a lot of mistakes as a country for almost three decades now because we have too often replaced evidence and argument with assertion, attack, and assumed superiority. And since I think my side is about to have a big victory, I don't want us to fall into the trap that I think the most conservative ideological Republicans have fallen into and taken our country down with over the last 30 years. Evidence and argument still matters. The facts still matter. One of the most interesting intellectual influences on me was a constitutional law class I took with Professor Robert Bork, who, as you might imagine, I agreed with on nearly nothing. And I remember I had an argument with him once, and I said, I wrote about this in my book, I said, but your argument, Professor, is circular. And he said, of course, all the best arguments are. Now, he had a theory about what the Constitution was supposed to do, and he tried to fit all the facts into that theory, and what had to be ignored had to be ignored. It is a very dangerous way to run a free society that's dynamic and changing. And I actually filed testimony that I wrote myself based on my interpretation of Judge Bork's antitrust rulings, primarily against his nomination when Joe Biden was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee and he was nominated to the Supreme Court. I liked him, I respected him, but I disagreed with him. And I strongly feel, after all these years, these 35 years, that maybe the simplest, best thing I came away with at Yale in the combination of law and policy and evidence and argument is that if you're a lawyer, if you're a public servant, or if you just want to be an enlightened citizen, you have to see this incredibly complex, kaleidoscopic reality that we have. Do your best to synthesize it in a way that clarifies knowledge without distorting it. There is no perfect solution, and we all need checks on our own conclusions. But after all these years, I still feel that way, and I am profoundly grateful for the role that Yale had. I'm also grateful that Marvin Cherylstein didn't flunk me in tax for having Gabriel Garcia Marquez's novel there. He would have been well within his rights. I was a miserable tax student. First of all, I was, I never would have met a good tax lawyer because I think people should actually pay their taxes, and I think it's great. I think whenever we go around asking for decades of government more than we're willing to pay for, we're just setting ourselves up for real trouble. But I'm very grateful for that. My life now, except for Hillary's campaign and when in other election seasons when they kind of pull me out for a week or two, like an old horse they take out of the barn. You want to see if you can get around the track one more time without breaking a leg. It is my foundation work, the work I do around the world. But I spend enormous amount of times doing something that I was made painfully, acutely, and humbly aware of as president, which is trying to help people turn their good intentions into actual changes in other people's lives. And I would urge all of you who care about all this to think about that. Mario Cuomo once famously said that we campaign in poetry, but we govern in prose. There is an enormous amount of difference between making a speech and making a change. There's even an enormous amount of difference between passing a law and making a change. If I had been in the United States Congress, I would have voted for this financial relief package. But the real deal is going to be what happens now. I personally believe that it won't be fully effective unless we add, as Hillary announced, Senator Obama, Barney Frank, and others have asked for, a housing component, which, like the Home Ownership Loan Corporation in the Depression, would allow the government also to require the renegotiation of as many mortgages as can be renegotiated and people can be saved. There are about 1 million people left in their homes in the Depression as a result of mortgage renegotiations. And while this law says that if you take assistance from the federal government, you have to make every effort to do that, it also says doing that can't cost the taxpayers any money, whatever that means, and it's going to be very haphazard. And by the way, here's why you should have been for the law and you should be for this. It is an imperfect piece of legislation, but it will get the basic credit and lending system going again. There was a period about 10 days ago when the biggest car dealer in America stopped financing car loans. I live in Westchester County, one of the wealthiest counties in America. Every living soul I knew was trying to get every penny out of a bank over $100,000. The capacity of banks to lend, solid, stable, good banks, was shrinking, and we were going to get to the point where you couldn't get an installment loan to buy a refrigerator or a television. And if we had gone into the Christmas season with that sort of financial paralysis, God only knows what would have happened to this economy, never mind the stock market, where, parenthetically, it's not about Wall Street. Over half the American people have a direct or indirect investment in stocks. Last week, one of America's biggest consumer companies, which has to move big amounts of money overnight because they have thousands of stores all over America, paid 6%, issued paper at 6% for overnight money because they would rather do that than keep over $100,000 in any bank account. They were so scared. 2 hours later, they decided they had bought too much money for the next day, and they tried to buy some of their paper back at a premium above 6%. It was madness. We had to normalize the financial system again. But how it's done is important. We can actually get the taxpayers their money back, may even make a slight profit if it's managed properly. But you should want a housing component for the following reasons. And by the way, all the poll shows, this shows why you can't govern in a complex situation by polls. American people didn't want me to go into Bosnia or Kosovo either, but they were glad we did it once we did it. And 80% of them were against giving Mexico a loan. But when they paid it back 3 years early with $600 million profit, they were glad we did it. You cannot do this. The schizophrenia of complex situations was apparent when majorities of people said, I'm against this relief package, and I'm really mad at Congress for not doing something. So you got to follow the do-right rule when something like this happens. You just got to try to figure it out and figure out what will work and do it. So if you took a poll today, most Americans would also not want us to provide mortgage relief for people who had subprime mortgages. And when the interest-only period ran out, the monthly payment was raised, or because it was a risky loan, the interest rate was raised, and now they can't make the monthly payment. But you should, if these people are hardworking, honest, and can make the monthly payment. Because every time you foreclose on a home, the macroeconomic cost is $225,000 on average in America. In expensive urban areas, can get up to $350,000 because the house will not be resold for the original purchase price, because local government loses property tax revenues, and because your neighbor's home value goes down. So we're going to have 2 million foreclosures this year. We had about 1.5 million last year, and we'll have another 2 million next year unless this is done. At $225,000, if my math is right, that's $450 billion. That's more than half the aggregate amount of this financial rescue package. So it will exert a significant drag on the economy and cause enormous dislocation. But I think it should be done. Which brings me to the central point. What's the biggest challenge facing America? The biggest challenge is we are not organized for the interdependent world of the 21st century. We have too much inequality, we have too much instability, and our economic model is totally unsustainable because of the way we use energy and contribute to global warming. So the work of the next president, the next Congress in our country, and increasingly around the world, but here, let's just focus on, will be to reduce inequality in incomes, access to capital, jobs, education, and healthcare, to repair the financial system in all of its ramifications so that it works for ordinary people again, and restore America's standing in the world as a leading force for peace and freedom and prosperity, principally by working with others to create a world with more partners and fewer adversaries, and to deal with the inequality problem, the unsustainability problem, and the insecurity problem. At home, once you get past the financial mess, I think the most important things we have to do are to make a serious commitment to a clean, efficient, maximally independent energy future, because it will create jobs, create businesses, raise incomes, reduce climate change, and improve national security. I also believe we have to invest a not insignificant amount of our foreign assistance money in helping other countries at every level of economic development do the same thing. And it's really important. And more, I found that as I worked through the UN or with my global initiative, that more and more leaders of developing countries are realizing that when you push clean energy at them, or you push efficiency at them, you're not, as they suspected 10 years ago when Al Gore and I tried to do the Kyoto Treaty, and the Senate voted against it 98-0 before I even sent it to them. It's the only bill I ever lost before I sent it to Congress. But they no longer believe that we're just trying to keep them poor. Among other things, we're going to have to figure out how to make poor countries much more self-supporting when it comes to food production. The World Bank finally admitted about a month ago that they had been wrong to discourage poor countries from becoming self-sufficient in food production since 1981. And if you look at the spiraling food prices, part of it is the energy inputs necessary not just for transportation of food, but for fertilizer. And we're going to have to, I'll make you a prediction. When those of you who are students here now come back for your 35th reunion, you will have a much higher percentage of food you consume grown within 150 miles of where you live than is the case today. The average meal travels 1,000 miles to an American. So we're going to have to work on all these things. But energy is the key. It swamps everything else in both its potential to do good and harm, and gives us a way to unify the world in a way that will discourage destructive protectionism and at the same time build more self-sustaining economies. Second thing we have to do in America is to do something serious about health care. Before we were swamped by this recent economic crisis, I would have said that we had better than a 50-50 chance to get comprehensive health care reform next year. Now it sort of depends on how we manage the budgetary implications and how much space there is in the system. But I went to 300 towns for Hillary, 300 separate towns, in just March, April, May through June 3rd. Maybe a couple hundred before that, but just in those 3 months, I went to more places in less time than I ever did as president or as a candidate for president. And everywhere I went, that's all I heard were these horrible health care stories. Families with disabled children, or children with severe conditions that they might get over but were expensive now, being told that the only way they could stay together and still eat would be for the parents to divorce so that the mother could go on Medicaid and the father could keep making a living. And a lot of these people were old-fashioned American small-town conservatives who typically voted Republican, as well as some who typically voted Democrat. They didn't like being told that when they worked hard, paid their taxes, did everything they were supposed to, the only way they could save their kids' lives and still make a living was to get a divorce. This is madness. And we are spending 16% of our income on healthcare. No one else is spending more than 11, none of our competitors. If you want to know where the money goes, McKinsey and Company finally did a study last year. It's really interesting that you can get, or just read the executive summary, which goes through dollar for dollar what the difference in our 16% of income going to healthcare is and 11% in all of our major competitors, even though we only insure 84%, everyone else insures 100. But over the long run, we cannot restore balanced, sustained growth to the American economy and social justice, continuing to spend 5% of GDP we shouldn't be spending and stick it to millions of people. And it's very understated to say that 16% uninsured, because at any given time during the year, about 30% of the people will be without insurance. And a lot of people who have insurance are underinsured. Last year, 45% of working age Americans said they were having trouble with medical costs. One other thing I want to say about that, we should be doing more on this around the world too. The most popular thing President Bush has done as president in the rest of the world is the AIDS and malaria initiative. There are actually two big chunks of the world where America's popularity has not waned as people have turned against the Iraq War and never liked our excessive unilateralism. The first is in the former communist countries who like us because we wanted them to be in the European Union and NATO. The second is in about 10 countries of Central and Eastern Africa where they see America through the prism of the president's AIDS and malaria program and what the Gates Foundation does, what I do with my AIDS program and other people. They think we're on their side. Nobody expects America to agree with them all the time. If Senator Obama's elected, and I fully expect him to be, he'll be wildly popular in Africa because his father's from Kenya. But I promise you, he will not be able to make every single decision for the next 4 years that majorities of people in all those countries will agree with. That's not the deal. People don't want you to agree with them all the time. They want to know that you care about them, that you respect them, that you want their children to live. So I think we should do more of that. And increasingly, that will mean, if you want to deal with inequality, making life-saving medicines fully affordable to people and helping them build health systems. With AIDS medicine, for example, now we've negotiated prices that are so inexpensive that about half of all the people have been added in the world to those getting AIDS medicine since 2004 have gotten it off contracts. Our foundation has negotiated, even though we spend just a pittance of the amount of money that the federal government does. But we still can't get medicine to everybody because the delivery systems are not there. Ethiopia, one of the countries in which I work, has almost 80 million people. When we started there, they only had 700 clinics outside the cities in the entire country. So we're helping them to go to 3,500 clinics. Otherwise, all the work we did on medicine doesn't amount to anything. Another problem we have is getting, particularly with malaria, that, and the Bush administration has found this, and the next administration will find this, even if they fund this big new expansion, there is a real limited availability of affordable malaria medicine out there. And part of this is because of the way medicine is produced and sold and patented around the world. On the way in here today, the dean and the dean of students at the law school introduced me to two law students and a medical student who are out here in the crowd who are working on the idea that the universities, which are big engines of biomedical research, should be able to take a lead in changing America's policy so that the patent process does not prevent life-saving drugs in new areas from getting to people who need them. I live with this every day. And when we started in Tanzania on malaria, everybody was buying malaria medicine, and half the people in Tanzania, by the way, get it from the government stores and half get it from private pharmaceuticals. And everybody was buying what they could afford, and it's utterly worthless. The only thing that's available now costs 10 times that, so we brokered lower costs and cut it some. But there is an enormous amount of work that needs to be done in the area of AIDS, TB, malaria, infections related to dirty water, neglected tropical diseases, the whole nine yards. 25 years ago, the Congress passed a bill which at the time was a very good thing, but all things that are good have limits, as we have painfully learned in the financial sector lately. What this bill says is that if Yale gets a big federal grant from the NIH or gets private funds to do biomedical research and you come up with a new life-saving drug, you're not in the business of making medicine, right? So you have the right to sell your discovery to a pharmaceutical company and to reap the financial benefits of it, which is good for the university and good for the ongoing enterprise. The problem is the work of the university then gets fed into the patent system and becomes a part of the problem instead of part of the solution. So these young people who met with me think the universities ought to take the lead in moving away from that and at least be able to use your discoveries under conditions that would guarantee affordable medicines that save millions of lives. Now, I like that because that's turning good intentions into positive changes. And that's the last point I want to make. I already told you how important I think energy is. So if you ask any climate change advocate, what's the biggest tragedy in the last decade? They'll say America walked away from Kyoto, right? Guess what? 170 countries signed it. 15 of them met the targets, no problem, because they were former communist countries and their economies collapsed after the date. So they can't get back to emitting as many greenhouse gases as they did in 1990. About 155 had to try. You know how many are going to meet the targets? Between 6 and 8. And the leaders of those other countries were not lazy, dishonest, and crooked. They weren't lying when they signed it. They weren't just trying to join a club so they wouldn't be looked at askance. They just couldn't figure out how to turn their good intentions into positive changes. The countries that have done so have, by and large, escaped the inequality trap. Denmark grows their economy 50% without one more watt of electricity, increases their reliance on wind energy to now 25%, so they reduce greenhouse gases and grew. Sweden, same deal. Germany, close. Great Britain will beat their Kyoto targets 20%, and until the recent spike in oil prices had no increase in income inequality in this decade, even though their economy is more like ours than any other European economy. So I ask you all to think about that. How are we going to turn our good intentions into positive changes? There's been a lot of talk in the press about whether this financial crisis was caused by this, that, or the other law or failure of regulation. But one of the things that you should think about is this. In the first half of this decade, 40% of our growth came from housing. Virtually 100% of the rest, or 60%, was from consumer spending. And therefore, it shouldn't be surprising that you had too much money being crammed into the housing funnel with more and more bright young people, not much older than you, trying to figure out how to turn this money over with clever and clever and clever devices in housing, and that people maxed out their credit cards and took second mortgages on their homes and wound up in a world of hurt here. If we had had a serious job strategy, and this is the last thing I want to tell you, if you're interested in America and American politics, American economics, you cannot run a big country in an open economy unless you have a strategy for new jobs every 5 to 8 years. New businesses, new growth. If half of the capital that went into housing had gone into building a clean, independent energy future, we wouldn't have had near the problems we've had. And people would have been making money the old-fashioned way into some, instead of devising some new, further leveraged derivative. Now, there were regulatory problems. I don't want to get out of it. But I want you to think about that. And I want you to understand we got about 10 years where we have a real chance to make an impact to avoid the worst calamities of climate change and about 10 years' worth of new jobs and new businesses, and broadly shared prosperity in urban and rural areas across all racial, ethnic, and religious and cultural lines that we can get out of energy. Then we'll need something else. My best guess is if we democratize it, it'll be biotechnology. But it's just a guess. I don't know. You can know. And so I will close with that. Yale was about law and policy and evidence and argument. All those things are necessary to turn good intentions into concrete changes that benefit everyone. Thank you.
The following podcast was produced by the Yale Law School on Saturday, October 4th, 2008.